Well, this is John McEwen again on the Americana Music Show here on syndicatednews.net. And my favorite thing about doing this is I get to talk to some, well, some friends that I've run into over the years. Today we have Chip Davis. Hey, Chip.
Hey, John. Good talking with you.
You know, you've been an inspiration to me before I met you. I don't know. When did we meet?
I think the first time we met was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
That was the first time?
I think that at the fair, or else we met before that when your son was out here in Omaha. It might have been the first.
Yeah, I met Johnny Adams way before that, your guy that handles a lot of road stuff.
And, right.
And I felt like I've known you because you're in my life the way... See, people don't know yet that I'm talking to a guy that had a big hit record called Wolf Creek Pass.
Yeah, that was a top 40 record. And then, of course, Convoy was even bigger. I had 13 number one country hits in a row, and Convoy was number 7 and sold 20 million copies.
Oh, come on.
It was a huge record. And then a movie got made about it, and with Kris Kristofferson and Ally McGraw. And that was kind of wild. I scored the movie, but I wrote the record.
That was a really neat thing, and that was back in the 70s, right?
Yes, it was like 76, I think.
Well, what happened after that?
Well, there's been a lot of different things that I've explored. Some I've explored most recently using music for medical use, and I'm currently doing a lot of work with the armed forces and like particularly submarines and in special, like in the space station, places like that with NASA and with the government, where people are put into situations where they could get claustrophobic. And I've come up with a particular type of algorithm that puts out the sounds that are very spatial type of sounds and create space where there isn't space. So it can actually dilute claustrophobia. And so that's where it's been useful in submarines and in the space station and some of those kind of applications. We have 94 hospital rooms currently, out at the National Intrepid Center. We're there where the soldiers are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan to help with psychological normalization. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of been my most recent incarnation. I'm probably most known, besides C.W. McCall, I'm probably most known for the Christmas albums, which I've sold over 35 million of.
I was going to get to that, Chip, because I think it's fascinating that people don't know. This is kind of a behind-the-curtain thing, you know, like I'm the banjo player in the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band to some people, or the guy that plays the fiddle. But I do other things, and I like people to know about it. I'm proud to know you, but I also say thank you for all those years of Mannheim Steamroller, which was after all the C.W. McCall stuff, right?
Yes, and in fact, a kind of a little-known fact that's kind of fun is that the band, the keyboard players and guitar players and all those guys... are the same players that are Mannheim Steamroller, except we have two Mannheim Steamrollers that tour now. We've gotten to that level of popularity. But the core of Mannheim Steamroller is the old C.W. McCall band.
Did the country music thing play itself out? Did you find that it was like getting the same, or you didn't have control? You were dealing with major label record companies and their wishes and desires. Did they clash with you? And what drove you to go to Omaha and do something totally opposite?
Well, it was through the jingle business that I came to Omaha. I was writing music for some of the big advertising agencies, which had their world headquarters located here in Omaha. And so in the process of doing that, I started writing these country commercials, which is kind of funny because I said, there's two things I will never do in my life. One is write country music, and the second is live in Nebraska. So here I am 32 years later with a bunch of country hits, you know.
Well, and did that lead to Mannheim Steamroller, or were the jingles first?
Yeah, actually, my jingle players that were... You know, we're recording all this commercial music are the same guys then when we one of the commercials really took off and became the C.W. McCall legacy. And that led us into the doing the records. And
what,
so,
what was that?
That was Wolf Creek Pass, was Old Home Fill Up and Keep on a Truckin' Cafe was the first record to go into, you know, the top 10 country. Then Wolf Creek Pass was next, and that went into top 40, and then we had a whole string of them right in a row. And then, of course, Convoy was number one worldwide for 2 weeks in a row. So it was
a
big record, 20 million copies. And
you know what's really neat about that song that I know, because I've heard people talk about it, is that when people were on the government bases, Air Force, Army, whatever, around the world, and they'd hear a song like that, it made them really feel back home.
And yeah, absolutely.
It was really a reflection. And your story, see, to me, you may not, I mean, I it's like Paul Williams, a different level. Paul Williams is a good friend of mine for 40 years, and, you know, he came to town to Los Angeles in a stolen car, and he went to where the Muppet Studio is now, the old A&M Studio, which used to be the Chaplin Studio.
Yes. Uh huh.
Well, he pulled up.
I think where the Carpenters used to record. I think.
Well, that's part of that story. Is Paul pulled up to that building, went in and, to work on a commercial, and somebody said, you know, why don't you make that song longer? It's a good. It was a bank commercial. About just beginning. I'm going to begin, and we're going to go to the bank and buy a house. And the guy said, make it longer, and I'll take it downstairs to this group. It was the song We've Only Just Begun.
No kidding.
He paid for that car the next week.
That's great.
And then he started writing for the Carpenters, and all out of going after a dream. That's something that I try to get across in this discussion, Chip, is that you're a person that just pursued your dream and did it. And Mannheim, I mean, that's a fabric of soundtrack of my family's life. You know, Christmas time, we're always playing that stuff. What led you to become the businessman, not just doing it with a record company like had been the C.W. McCall experience?
Well, probably... The business part came along because there wasn't really anybody else to do it. And I had to figure it out, you know, how the music business worked with publishing and mechanical rights and copyrights and all those sort of things. And when we were doing the C.W. McCall stuff, I was the partner that was always responsible for all of that business part of it. And that got me started doing it, and then gradually, little by little, I learned more about taking over the whole studio aspect of it, and then the electronics and how the electronics play into, you know, making good use of the studio, creating unique sounds, and, you know how important echo content and some of those things can make or break a record. And,
yeah.
You know, it takes some time in the studio to start figuring out how to make use of all the tools that are available. And of course, gosh, today, you know, in today's world, I'm working on a Pro Tools 9 operation down in my studio. And it's just phenomenal.
Yeah, that is phenomenal. What's phenomenal that people should know is that you have been able to do this. And what did it take? Hard work. And what do you do?
Yeah, like they say, Carnegie, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? practice.
Yeah. Well, in your pursuit of this, of building AG, can you tell people what AG is?
Well, first off, the name American Gramophone, when I came up with that for the name of the record label, I had in my own mind that I wanted it to be an American version of Deutsche Grammophon.
Ah, yeah.
So Deutsche Grammophon is, like, you know, of course, one of the greatest record labels of all time, and particularly very strong in classical music and all of that. And so, ironically, when we got started with C.W. McCall on American Gramophone, I did end up having quite a bit of contact with PolyGram and a lot of the German counterparts to Deutsche Grammophon in the pop area. So it was kind of a unique it was an exciting experience actually for me, because I was talking to the actual guys. I got to meet one of the partners who actually started Deutsche Grammophon. So,
wow.
It was an incredible experience. And then to hear their stories, and, you know, really wasn't too different than our story out here. The way they built things from scratch, and, you know, back when, there isn't, as you all know, there isn't any roadmap for building
well,
a business.
Well, do you get a certain amount of pleasure out of the fact that you were a country drummer and singer in a band and you wanted to do something, but the companies said, oh, no, drummers don't make instrumental records that sell, and drummers don't arrange classical-sounding music and redo Christmas songs. But instead, you did something like Land's End, and you went to a completely faraway space compared to Nashville, L.A., Hollywood. Nashville, New York, L.A.,
yeah.
And you made it work. You must have, what is your feeling about that?
well, you know, one of the things I've heard quite often throughout my life, my business life, with the way I've treated my art and the people and everything, is people say quite often, boy, Chip, you really, man, you think out of the box. So I always come back with, what box?
Yeah.
Is there a box?
Yeah. I think you think of a whole new box. And, the Chip Davis box, Mannheim Steamroller, is parked in a very special place. And you know something, Chip? It's the quality and the depth that you, the quality of the music and the depth that you reach people's lives that does something else that I bet you're proud of. I would be if I was you, or happy about. Your shows, Mannheim Steamroller shows, in the last couple of years have been selling tickets like everything is fine. So when people go there, they do feel everything is fine. Your concert attendances are up so much, you've made two different groups, right?
Yes. We've got two touring companies. We went from when I started doing this, we do it around the Christmas season, maybe 6 to 10 shows where we would go park in a city and play about 3 or 4 shows. Then we go to another city, and then pretty soon we'd run out of time. It would be Christmas, and we'd quit. Now we have 94 concert stops between the two touring groups. So the East Coast and West Coast companies, actually they crisscross at one point on this tour coming up, but there's 94 different dates. And at the same time, I redid for Universal Studios Orlando the music to The Grinch That Stole Christmas.
Nah.
And they have, and so, yeah, so I go down on, I go down there on, every Friday, Saturday of the month of December, and I'll be conducting an 80-piece orchestra playing my renditions of the Grinch music with a big orchestra.
Cool.
And, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I did one 3 years ago, and everybody went, hey, that worked pretty good. Maybe we should try 3 next year. So we did 3 the next year, and that went really good. So they said, well, maybe we should try more. And then now it's like up to where we're doing it every weekend, Fridays and Saturdays. So we're doing a total of 8 of them to 10. We might start right after Thanksgiving and then get going. So, and that's built a really nice audience. We have approximately 20 to 25,000 people show up at those concerts.
Do you mean each concert 20 to 25,000?
Yes. Each concert, and I don't know what'll happen when we go to Fridays and Saturdays, if that's going to dilute the audience or not. But it's a stand-up concert, and it's a free concert as part of their ticket to go to Universal theme parks.
Oh, I see.
So the people that are in the park then can just come over and, you know, come right into the concert. They either have the choice of, you know, taking off or coming into the concert, and we've just been seeing tremendous crowds. So that's
when you go out. When you go out and do your touring, your normal touring, this is not a small entity, a small situation, because you usually play, 3,000 to 5,000 seat halls?
Yes. We've gone through 2 different incarnations as far as audience size. I started with the 3,000 seat, sort of the Orpheum-type theaters and Paramounts and all of those. And then we got to the point where we were playing arenas, and we played 20,000-seat arenas because we could do more seats and moved the show about every third day. We had 11 semis, two buses, and an airplane to get from place to place. And we played the big 20,000-seat arenas for about 12 years, I believe. And then I was hearing from the audience all the time, we wish we could be back in the smaller theaters where it's more intimate. And I thought, what the heck, let's try it. And ironically, the cost of operations shrunk so radically that despite the fact we went down in audience size, the bottom line came up. And so we were actually doing better business-wise by doing that. And the audiences were very satisfied. So we're hanging in there around the 2,500, 3,000-seat venues now.
Well, that's a great thing. That's a great way to see somebody. And you can catch Mannheim Steamroller, the website, Mannheim Steamroller?
Yes, we have the website. It's just ManheimSteamroller.com.
Now, you've done something that is quite outside of the, like we said earlier, a whole new box. Record sales have been talked about nationally with between bands and solo artists and the different situations. Oh, the record business has gone away. Do you feel like it's gone away, or is because of your planning you've been able to be ready for the change of how people buy stuff, buy music?
We were pretty much ready, and I've scaled my company and my activities to the change, but we had a big surprise last year. Put out a 2-disc, 25-cut set of the Christmas music from the various albums. And so some of these cuts go back to the original albums, which are no longer, retail doesn't carry, you know how retail is. I mean, if it's not absolutely brand new, they don't carry it. And so a lot of times hardcore fans that, you know, they've lost a couple of the CDs along the way, try to go find it again. It's difficult. So I put this 2-disc set out to sort of help satisfy that. And we did, you know, 100 to 200,000 units in today's world is pretty much a hit record. What used to be maybe a million units is now 100,000. Well, and last year we did 750,000. So, I mean, we basically, with that 2-disc set, and that was a 2-disc set too. So we
had a whole run. Well, the thing about that, it was a 2-disc set that had some music on it that was 15, 20 years old?
Yeah, oh, easily, maybe 30. Yeah, back to 1984, Deck the Halls and some of those cuts I put on there because you can't find them anywhere else. So this gave the audience an opportunity to bring those cuts back into their homes at Christmas time or buy them for their kids. Like, hey, I grew up listening to this stuff, and I'd like you to hear it too. And it was always part of our... I've heard this story so many times that a lot of people put my records away with their Christmas ornaments. So when they get out their Christmas stuff, first thing they do is throw on a Mannheim CD and off they go.
How do you feel about the rest of the year?
Well, you know, I've done this stuff with the, we're doing this stuff with Music of the Spheres for NASA, and we have a whole tour that's for that. And then I came up with, I thought, you know, it only took me 25 years to figure out that there was other holidays besides Christmas. So I came out with a Halloween record, and which is kind of unusual because there isn't any real identifiable repertoire to go with Halloween like what we have with Christmas carols.
Mm-hmm.
So I started just digging through things that, you know, you could kind of loosely associate with spooky, like the Bach D minor toccata in Fugue. And then what I did was I Mannheimized those, like what I did with the Christmas carol. So I'd take it, play first part of the tune real straight so everybody know what it was, and then go off on a tangent, you know, go out of the box. Out of box.
You'll find that steamroller
anyway,
box.
Yes, and we drive away into the sunset with it. So yeah, I did Halloween. I've done a couple of Halloween albums that all did real well, not to the degree that Christmas does, but they did very well for the first time trying a different holiday. And then I did a 4th of July. We've got American Spirit for around that time of the year. And then around the February time of the year, I've got four romance albums that are so we've kind of got each major holiday block has a set of albums that kind of can go with that. And we started doing specials on our website, like, you know, instead of a dozen roses, you get, you know, one of these albums to give to your, you know, significant person you want to give it to during Valentine's Day, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd start giving suggestions on gift giving and things like that.
You know, I've heard a lot, and I read a lot about Chip Davis, the businessman, and I hear you throwing out these figures. We did 700 here, and we have this for this period. But I've seen your shows. I've talked to you. I've known you a little while. I still feel like there's a lot of this. You just want to reach people with your music and your interpretation of music. And I think the numbers are just a reflection that you've got an idea that a bunch of people like. How do you feel about that? Is that your purpose, to reach people? Obviously, since you're doing this other music research and reaching them that way.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the bottom line is I believe that as a composer, my job is to help people get in touch with their own feelings. And sometimes the pieces need to be sad so you can be happy. So, you know, you need to run, I call it, you know how physical therapists refer to the range of motion, you know, of like of your elbow or something.
Mm-hmm.
I refer to this as the range of emotion.
Ah.
And I think, you know, touching different feelings in a person, you know, a certain amount of us is made up of intellect and a certain amount is heart. And so I try to, in each album, have a balance between the head and the heart. So stuff that makes people think or that really rocks out, and then stuff that maybe is just really pretty or might be sad and make you contemplative.
Now, what percentage of your music, for those that don't know, what percentage of it is instrumental only?
Oh, probably about 95%.
That's what I thought. So it must be a very tough choice to actually find something with words that's going to get in the way of all those notes you want to put in. I've had the interview question before. What's it like to be in a band that, I mean, because with Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, we've had, I think, 24 chart records, you know? And I said, well, for me, since I didn't sing any of them, for me, what it's like to be on the radio is, you can hear me play for about 8 seconds, and then some guy starts singing. And usually over that 8 seconds, the radio guy is saying, and here they are with blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And down at the end of the song, I'll play for another 8 or 10 seconds, but that's when they start saying, and stay tuned to KBBB. And I said, so that's what it's like.
Yeah, no kidding.
You get Chip Davis out there, and I'm glad that you have a passion for reaching people.
Yes, you know, I'm the son of two music teachers. My dad was a music teacher and choir director for 30 years, and my mother was a music teacher, and both of my grandmothers were piano teachers, and my grandfather was a country doctor back in Ohio, literally horse and buggy doctor in his early years when he first came out of college, but I grew up as a third generation musician on both sides of my family, and probably part of it is I didn't know what else to do because, like, I was just saturated in it. But I always loved it. And it's just, you know, I've wanted to put forth my version, my feelings, and how to reach people. And then from my grandfather, I think I picked up this fascination with medicine and how that the auditory nerve can sense different things and sounds and different algorithms that can actually affect your health. And that's where I've gotten off on this whole medical spin, is using music to reach inside different parts of your brain and your body to help heal people.
Would this be analogous to the effect that light has on people, like how bad that fluorescent lighting is when it's in buildings, people are sicker, and the pulsating of the 60-cycle pulsing fluorescent light makes people ill? But one of my good friends is an inventor, and he has this special light is being used in nuclear reactors and submarines that it helps replicate the rhythm of daylight. Not just the rhythm, but it's not an algorithm. It's just the color temperature.
Yeah,
and
the Calvin temperature, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
It's exactly the same sort of thing. 'Cause with the audio, you know, with light and of course color theory, you know, the density of different colors as far as the Calvin temperature and some of those things go, yellow light is going to give you a different feeling than a blue light, which I think comes down to our basic nature. A gray day might have more blue in it, but a beautiful sunrise or sunset with a lot of yellow is going to make you feel differently. And I think it's analogous to that, that, you know, light and audio, our sensory perceptions as human beings are affected by all the things around us. And I use those tools with my ambient stuff. We have actually goggles that we can put on people and do color theory at the same time we're doing some of this, these algorithms. And it's a very consuming sort of thing. And you know where it's really had a wonderful application is people that are having chemotherapy and that they're put into circumstances that's very uncomfortable. It's scary. They, you know, worried about themselves. And this can really help take your mind off of the situation you're in. And when it involves medication like that, we've discovered that the medications have a better penetrating effect to the person when they're in a much more relaxed mode.
This is along the lines of sing to your plants or sing to your chickens, they'll have better eggs.
Yeah.
This is along the lines of the mother singing to the unborn baby and it's born in a mellower situation.
Yes.
Or the new baby, and it's born with a better attitude if it's had music around it. It sounds to me like you need to make an album for your next MRI person. Next time you go to have an MRI, take the Mannheim Steamroller MRI special.
We actually have tried to devise an experiment. One of our medical partners that we work with is the Mayo Clinic up in Rochester in the cardiovascular rehab department. And through them, I came up with the problem with the MRIs is, of course, taking wires and headphones and things. We can make a binaural version of these algorithms, but the headphones and wires. So we haven't done this yet, but my concept was to do it pneumatically. Do you remember back on the airline?
The airline headphones.
Yeah, the airline headphones. They were just tubes.
It was just like the tube. Sorry to interrupt, but you got me excited. It's like the tube on the ship where the captain would yell in the voice tube, rudder to one half, you know, and it would go down a voice tube. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so with neoprene tubing, I think we could run that into an MRI, and that's one of the experiments we've wanted to try to do at some point in time.
Chip, how do you find enough time? You have a good organization, I think. You have a lot of things that are cooking along there. It's really wonderful.
Well, it's you know, it's just fun to do these things. It's not a chore, and also, you know, I mean, I'm not doing this all, you know, we're talking about this in a very brief period of time about a lot of topics, but it's done, you know, this has been over a period of time as I've developed these things. And one of the things I'm working on right now that I'm really jazzed about is I'm working on a new album for the first time in a couple of years. It just sort of dropped out of everything because I was trying to figure out where the record business was going and all of that. Anyway, the new album is called Exotic Spaces. And I've been having the most fun with this new Pro Tools system because it's got virtually every instrument available to mankind is in that thing, you know? And so when I do, I did a piece about pyramids, I could use all these great Egyptian instruments, period instruments and current instruments, and then write it in an Egyptian sort of style. And I wrote a piece for Taj Mahal, and this with sitars and all of the Indian instruments. And, of course, having this in Pro Tools right at your fingertips just makes it so accessible. It's just I'm having a blast doing this right now.
How much do you sleep every night, Chip, average?
Oh, probably normal, you know, 7-8 hours, something like that.
Some people I know, just the usual 5 or 6 hours. But you're normal. So that's good. 7 or 8.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm actually sometimes I write. I have written pieces in my sleep. But I get an idea for something, and I'll jump out of bed and run down and hammer out something on the piano and do a quick sketch. Because if I lay there in bed and I have that in my head, I can't lay there any longer till I go commit it to something so I'll remember. So I've learned the lesson a long time ago that, I don't have to worry about that. I'll remember this in the morning.
Right.
And then you get up, it's like, Okay, did I think of something last night?
Well,
it's
just that thing about your subconscious thought of it, because it works as hard as your conscious does, only it doesn't talk out loud. You have to listen to it every now and then and get the teletype.
Yeah, absolutely.
That Einstein supposedly said his basic theory of relativity, equals mc squared, came to him in a dream. And I've known other people that had that happen. So
neat. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of validates the afternoon nap, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Chip, is there any one thing that this worldwide success that you've achieved, is there any one thing that you would say to somebody that's trying to get into the music business, make sure you don't do this? And then another one thing that you would say, make sure you do this. I get it all the time. I get people saying, I've got a band and we want to make it, or I write songs, and it's really tough. So I'm curious what you might say.
Well, I can answer the don't do this part pretty easily. Don't listen to other people. Follow your own star.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get talking to other people, I had so many people tell me, oh, you can't start your own record label. Omaha, Nebraska, are you crazy? You know, and if I had listened to all those people, I wouldn't have sold 50 million records or whatever crazy number it is now. And I wouldn't have been able to touch all these people and have all these fans. And I get so many fan letters that relate to particularly my Fresh Air music, with its healing power and how much good it has done for some poor soul in their family who is terminally ill or very sick, and how this music really helped them at different points in their life. And, you know, if I had listened to those people that said, oh, don't do that, that'll never work. I've heard that so much that I wouldn't have ever had the opportunity to touch these other lives.
Oh, that's good. And in pursuing the dream that somebody might have by not listening to others and having their own dream, what is the one thing you would say? You can have two, you can have whatever you want. But sometimes there's one thing that, like George Burns' advice to Steve Martin was, always take your wallet on stage. So, but that was meant to get the response it just got. But in a serious way, is there one thing that you could say to that new person that's trying to figure it out?
Yeah, don't wait. Don't wait for a major label deal to come along your way. It might not. So figure out a way, if it's through the internet or if whatever it is, to get your music out there and to reach other people. And then as you do, you will find out if you have fans or not. And if you do, then you're onto something. And as you begin to get onto something, those fans will start to tell other fans, and then you start to build an audience base. And so the key there is, don't sit and wait around for it to happen. Make it happen.
That's right. That's good advice. Well, Chip, I know you've got lots of stuff to do, and I very much appreciate you talking to the audience of the Americana Music Show. This is syndicatednews.net, and I look forward to seeing you up there. Or anywhere.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, John. It's great to talk with you, as always. And we'll sure look forward to seeing you again one of these days. And say hi to your son for me. And
yeah, he's working on getting the right thing for the Mannheim Planetarium show. For those that don't know, if we're still recording, my oldest son is a planetarium program designer, and he has shows running in, I believe, 8 or 9 countries right now. Such as Germany, Finland, Canada, Australia. And after a several years pursuit, I understand he's going to do, actually, I don't know, other than, Dad, guess what? Mannheim's in to do a Christmas planetarium show. So you can, don't even have to go out there. You can just go to the stars with Mannheim Steamroller.
Yeah, that's great. I'm really proud of him. We had a great time when he was out here apprenticing.
Oh, good. Yeah, he's a good guy. I'm proud of the way.
Yeah, good kid, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Chip, and say thanks to Johnny Adams for me for helping us coordinate.
Hey, I'm calling for you, John. Absolutely. Hey, thanks so much. It was great talking with you.
Same here. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, bye.